one do you want to do next?
Still the adult child sex. That's always a big seller.
Oh yeah.
Well, that I had good friends who said, "Are you crazy? Do not write that book."
Man, listen, you're talking to a guy who for 25 years has been making arguments more or less in defense of adult child sex in classrooms. I don't know if it's the same argument as yours, but I even authored a piece in the Daily Beast in which I called into question the age of consent laws, I brought to bear the arguments I was making in class, and I'm going to see whether they jibe or not. So adult child sex, Steve. So that's just the dumbest thing you could possibly argue. If you're interested in a career, if you're interested in respectability, if you're interested in being, you know, invited to dinner parties. So
yeah,
let's start there. Like, why on God's green earth are you as crazy as I am in taking on this argument?
So it's funny you mentioned. So I actually got interested in a kind of a roundabout way. What I was interested in is whether or not an act is wrong because it's harmful. So I actually got interested in it for theoretical reasons.
Right.
Because this seemed to be like a paradigm case. There's actually some meta studies which seem to suggest that in some cases, at least with regard to adult males and underage males, that it's not harmful, or if it is harmful, we can't decide whether the harm is due to the sex itself or the fact that society goes berserk over it. And so one of the articles I was reading said, look, this is wrong. We don't need to know whether it's harmful. The empirical question of whether or not there's any long-term harm we could track on this is really beside the point. And I was kind of struck with the question. I thought, well, it's not obvious to me why that is. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, the standard kind of other argument is that it's a right infringement. And I wasn't sort of convinced by that argument. Mm-hmm. And also when it comes to hebephilia rather than sort of adult child sex, so sex with like young teens, it's not clear to me. I mean, look, there's at least some reason to believe that that individuals are, you know, designed by evolution to begin reproduction at that period. So if they're designed by evolution to begin reproduction, it's not clear why it would be physically either harmful or emotionally harmful. And so there was kind of like three different explanations, none of which convinced me. One was that it was harmful. And I thought, well, there's at least a controversy whether that's empirically true. There's the right infringement case that we don't get, they can't give their valid consent, and therefore it's wrong in virtue of being a right infringement. And there's a view that it's exploitative, that even if it's not harmful, and even if it's not a right infringement, it's somehow an exploitation.
Right. I've heard all these. Yes. Okay.
Right. So those are the three dominant arguments. And none of these convinced me. So the harm argument, well, there's actual, like, you know, empirical controversy over this.
Sure. Yeah.
And the rights-based argument, I think, look, we make children do all sorts of things that
Thank
we don't
you.
Want to do.
Right? Thank you.
You know, we make them go to church. We make them go to the temple. We tell them to go to school. They got to go to the dentist. They got to go to their sister's ballet recital. And we don't care what they say. And they want to do things. We say no, right? They say, I want to stay up and watch, you know, Creature Feature on WPIX until, you know,
Thank
2
you.
In the morning. We say, well, it's tough.
That is all a child's life is coercion.
Right, that's right.
It's coercion by adults to make the child do something for the adult's pleasure only.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
You say, yeah, you're going to go to your great uncle's funeral, even though you want to go, and even though it's not in your interest.
Right.
So the rights-based argument's a little bit hard to follow. In addition, at least in some cases, certainly with regard to hebephilia and sort of underage sex.
What's the word about hebephilia?
Hebephilia would be like kind of younger teens.
Okay.
You know, just statutory rape cases, right, where the person's under the age of consent, which actually, as you know, varies quite a bit between states.
Indeed.
And in those cases, the individuals seem to be willing, right? So it's not like you even have, you know, you're sort of dragging someone, kicking and screaming into doing something they don't want to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The third thing about exploitation is really bizarre, because exploitation occurs when there's a kind of a transaction and both sides benefit from it, but one side usually the side of the stronger bargaining position takes an unfair share of the transaction surplus. That is, they take more than just share of the benefit of the transaction.
Right.
And you think, okay, well, even if that's true, it's never clear to me why exploitation is wrong, but even if that were not the case, right, because it's a mutually beneficial trade.
Yep.
But even if that were not the case, it wasn't clear to me, well, how do we know that the underage, you know, the young teenager or the the late prepubescent child isn't gaining as much from this, especially if they're a willing participant. Mm. And even if they didn't gain as much, how do we know that there aren't enough of other benefits, right? If someone, you had a tutor who's tutoring them in, you know, literature or the violin, why wouldn't the package of benefits be such that they're gaining more than their fair share of the transaction surplus? So I thought, well, look, there are three different explanations. The first one's, you know, in empirical controversy. And it's an odd view that whether or not it's permissible depends on the outcome of these studies.
Right.
The second view just seems to be a non-starter, right? We don't think that children have to give valid consent for pretty much anything we do to them,
right,
especially if they're willing participants. You know, we don't say, well, a child can't play kickball because they can't validly consent to it, even though they really want to play kickball.
Right.
And then last, exploitation. Again, I don't think exploitation is wrongful. I'm not exactly sure even what makes something exploitative.
Exactly.
If there were, I'm not sure what makes it wrongful. And even if it were wrongful, it's not clear that it occurs in most cases of adult child sex, or even let alone all of the cases.
Yep. Do you?
So that's what I thought. I looked into it. The other thing I felt free to write it as because I'm not a pedophile, and I don't engage in adult child sex. So I thought in some sense, look, I don't care if people attack me personally on it because it's not something that involves me directly.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas someone who is actually interested in this stuff, obviously they'd want to keep a low profile. They wouldn't want to argue for it. So in some sense, I'm free to make the argument in the sense that whatever, you know, you can call me all the names you want. It doesn't mean that it doesn't defuse my argument.
The only time I've ever gotten a death threat really from something I've written was the piece I wrote it in the Daily Beast about 12 years ago about Roman Polanski.
I really have to read that. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, it's a real short piece, but I come up with you and I think very much alike on this. You know, I kind of attack all those arguments that are made. Yeah, I mean, I say, come on. Children are coerced all day, every day to do all sorts of stuff, including stuff that is purely for the adult's gratification, which is also dangerous, like playing tackle football.
Right.
How many boys are coerced by their dads into playing tackle football when they really don't want to, which we now know causes serious brain damage, right?
Right.
And need I go on? I mean, there's just time after time, you know, instance after instance of adults coercing children to do things that they don't want to do. It's just nonstop coercion. It's really a plantation. I mean, it's the family, is it not? Like, there's no freedom in a family.
Right. That's right. And there's also like oddities. So take statutory rape law. Now, of course, the age of consent varies from some states, but take a state where the age of consent is 17 or 18, and let's say there's a four-year window. So you have a 23-year-old has sex with a 16-year-old, and you think, okay, well, that's a felony. The person's going to do, you know, real prison time for that.
Yep.
And you think, yeah, but if the 16-year-old had sex with another 16-year-old, that you think, okay, well, at least in some cases where they have Romeo and Juliet clauses, which require you to be in like a 3 or 4 year window, you say, well, that's okay. I think, well, why is it harmful or right infringing or have some other wrong making feature for a 16-year-old woman to have sex with a 23-year-old, but it's not if she has sex with a 17-year-old? Like what happens in the 6 years that turns nearly identical sex into from perfectly you know outside the criminal law to something that's a serious felony? Now one of the arguments you get is, well, look, overall the consequences are better if we have this law in place. Okay, I'm not entirely sure this is the case, but one, the burden should be on the people trying to criminalize it to show this is the case.
Mm-hmm.
Given how infrequently the stuff is prosecuted, it's not obvious to me that they could carry the burden. But in addition, we got to be a little careful about the sort of good consequences argument, because there's lots of things that, at least I think, we should protect liberty, even if it doesn't have the best results. So I'm kind of a liberty freak, and I tend to think, look, you know, there's a lot of things that are probably overall pretty harmful. Things, for example, like eating at fast food, you know, or drug use, or dropping out of high school, or you know, things like that. So it's not clear to me that we should criminalize these things even if they have overall worse results. So consequences are not going to justify criminalization in these other cases. It's not clear that merely because it produces bad consequences to allow the sex to occur, does that mean we should criminalize it?
Right.
So that's my concern.
Yeah, no, that's great. And to me, I always say, so what is the magical thing that happens on the moment you turn 18? There's this magical, gigantic wall between 18 and after 18, where this is a radical change. You can have legal sex 1 minute. You can't have legal sex 1 minute, and the next you can. It's utterly bizarre. But then, to me, also the really devastating, just empirical case against it is, Americans are so sure we're right about this, but look around the world. Look at age of consent laws around the world. I mean, you have European countries and advanced industrial democracies that have age of consent laws that are 13, 14, and 15. In fact, that's the norm in Europe, those ages.
That's interesting.
We are much higher than almost all other countries. They range all over the map, all over the world. From I think some countries have it at 12 even.
Right.
12 to 24, you know. Right. So,
and they range considerably within the U.S. too, between those who have 16 and those at 18.
That's right.
The states that have Romeo and Juliet laws and those that don't.
Right.
No, and also you look at human history, right? I mean, the notion that we have these statutory rape laws is a relatively new thing in human history. I mean, sure. As you know much better than me, fairly recent development.
Oh, yeah. Both pederasty and incest were... They may have been illegal in places, but the law wasn't really enforced, certainly through the Middle Ages. I mean, that's pretty much, I think, the consensus is that there was incest that was pretty rampant and no one just talked about it. There was no discourse about it. It was a non-issue until the modern era.
Right. And on some accounts, some of these laws were really aimed at preventing rape.
Yeah.
They weren't. I mean, and also you have then these other exceptions in addition to the Romeo and Julia laws. You have the kind of marriage exceptions.
Yep.
So somehow... Yep, right. When you have marriage, the sex that would otherwise be a felony becomes something that you can't prosecute, depending on the state, which tells us that what we're really trying to do is we're trying to protect against emotional harm or against sort of unwanted pregnancy. It's not clear that the sex per se is the problem. It's the consequences. And again, I'm not completely unsympathetic to the notion that certain things have such horrendous consequences in the aggregate that we want to criminalize them. Mm-hmm. But I think, one, it's clear who should bear the burden of proof on that. And two, there's a certain price to be paid. I mean, every time you put someone in jail for years, there's a huge cost to the individual, let alone to society.
Yeah.
And you have to show that, the cost-benefit analysis supports this.
There's a very slick, sophisticated postmodern argument, I guess, that says that the culture is what causes the harm in people. The cultural assumptions is what causes people to feel as if they've been harmed, which ends up feeling like actual harm, right? And we know psychosomatic illnesses, it's real. It's real, okay? I've had them. I know, I don't deny it at all.
Yeah.
Their realness in that way, but there is no physical basis for it. And there have been studies that have shown, I think there have been many studies that I think a majority of so-called victims of child sex abuse, basically, felt bad mostly by the fact that they enjoyed it.
That's interesting.
There's a huge amount of guilt about having enjoyed it or having wanted it in some way, right? Among many, which again, so that tells me that, society tells us 24/7 that this is the worst thing you can do.
Right.
This is the worst thing. I mean, being a Nazi is better than this. This is
right.
I mean, what do mass murderers do in prisons? They kill the pedophiles, right?
Right. That's right. The worst thing. The pedophiles are like morally below them.
This is the bottom of the bottom of the bottom, right? I mean,
right.
So,
And at the very least, we'd want to disentangle those effects, right? I mean, you might think that, so for a while, there were laws which prevented, Loving v. Virginia until 1967, mm-hmm. laws which prevented interracial marriage and in some cases interracial sex. Mm-hmm. And you might think, look, imagine we discovered that these things were harmful to the participants. I don't exactly know how we showed that, but imagine some long-term psychological study. We'd want to know, is the harm due to the fact that these society disapproves of it? Or is there something kind of the way in which human beings are structured psychologically?
Right.
And until we can disentangle those effects, we don't know which is producing it.
That's right.
So I think at the very least we could say, look, we need to know what's causing the harm, if there is any harm.
Right.
And also in looking at harm, we want to separate out those individuals who were willing participants and those who were unwilling participants.
Yep.
Because it's entirely unsurprising that unwilling participants were harmed.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't surprise. It's true for the adults. It's entirely plausible that it would be very much true for underage individuals.
Right.
But the interesting cases with regard to willing participants, are those individuals harmed?
Mm-hmm.
And there, I think, look, I mean, again, there's a controversy. And at the very least, we'd want to know the answer to that. And then with regard to the individuals that are harmed but were willing participants, we want to separate out, well, what's causing that? Is it the disapproval?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean.
My other empirical argument is I just ask the audience, do you know of anyone who had an illegal relationship in this way? Do you know of anyone, right? It's legion. I mean, I've known dozens and dozens of people who had illegal relationships when they were 15, 16, and the other person was in their 20s. Right. And especially, by the way, gay men. Gay men, it's super common for the first sexual experience to be with a man. And I have talked to many, many gay men who have described those experiences as fantastic and wonderful, right?
I mean, and from what I spoke to gay men to tell me that as well, and they all seem to say that, look, it allowed them to sort of discover their sexuality, become more comfortable with it.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, same thing with just heterosexual cases. It even shows up in Law and Order SVU when Olivia, you know, Benson, she said, look, I had one of these relationships. I thought it was fantastic at the time.
Oh, yeah?
So, yeah. So, I mean, you know, and given that she's SVU, you'd expect a much harder edged attitude. So, yeah, I mean, when even the anecdotes are mixed, yeah, I'm a little skeptical when you take away people's liberty about resting on anecdote. But to the extent that you do rest anecdote, you should at least have a unified account of anecdotes.
Do you have, and this is not my favorite question, so please feel free to just like kick this away. Sure. But like, do you have ideas about what the law should be?
So in general, so my first view is going to be the minimalist account, which is that it should be an empirically driven law. So we should, and that the burden is on those people who want to criminalize it. So one account is to say, look, at least into the middling, you know, teenage years, let's say, you know, 14 onward or so, that the burden is going to be on the person who wants to criminalize it to show that there's either real harm or there's a right infringement that's going on here.
Okay.
So that the, you know, it's not, the idea is the default position, not criminalization. The default position is legalization.
Okay.
After that, I kind of go back and forth because,
Are you talking about prepubescent and postpubescent?
So here's that's what I'm talking about, pubescent first, right?
Yeah. Okay.
And then I'll get to prepubescent next.
Gotcha.
So on the prepubescent case there, cause again, a lot of prepubescent sex with adults and prepubescent children doesn't involve intercourse. Involves various forms of sexual contact, but not intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
I've kind of mixed views. I mean, I have the strong suspicion that this stuff is going to be harmful in the aggregate, that it's sort of a dangerous road to go down. On the other hand, I have these other views, which is you couldn't criminalize something unless you can show that it really is harmful in the aggregate, and also the view there's no direct wrong maker other than aggregate harm. And then the additional view that I'm not sure that harm is a great test for what we want to criminalize, because lots of our liberties might involve activities that are indeed harmful, and we shouldn't criminalize them. We still shouldn't criminalize them because of the value we place on liberty.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of undecided as to what to do with the sex between adults and prepubescent children. Okay. What's your take on this?
Gosh, I don't see a reason for the laws. I see that they've done massive amounts of harm in this country. So you have about 1 million people on the sex offender registry forever.
Right.
And that ranges from people who have, you know, tied children down and raped them to people who were 19 and had sex with their 17-year-old girlfriend.
Right.
And everything in between. And, you know, I have many, many friends who began relationships when they were teenagers and they dated like their professors. You know, or their 30-year-old math teachers in high school, and then had a relationship for another 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 years. My ex-wife is now married to her ex-professor.
Sure.
You know, I mean, she, you know, after me, she went back to, and he's 20 years old. So I don't, you know, and it's also like the cultural taboo, the stigma is so intense. As I said, it's the worst thing. You don't think we do enough policing of this on our own as a society? Right. I mean, we, you know, the cultural reflex is to, as I said, kill these people. I mean, And that kind of does happen, you know, and there's a tremendous amount of policing going on.
Oh, and it's in, once you're on the registry, I mean, what happens to people is horrendous.
Oh, yeah.
The stories are and I mean, you raise a really good point. And the other thing is, we, at all times, rape is going to be severely punished. So it's not like we don't have a way to stop unwilling sex or in the case of teenagers, unconsented to sex.
Right.
So we have a fairly severe mechanism by which to deal with that.
Right.
So I think you raise a good point. So with the prepubescent children, the adults, as an overall policy, I kind of go back and forth. I'm very sympathetic to your approach. In terms of lowering the statutory rape law, I think there's an excellent case for that.
Oh, yeah. I mean.
So I think a very strong case for that. But to be honest with you, I when I discuss these things, and I normally don't discuss them because people just do not want to hear. They don't want to discuss it. They find it completely beyond the pale. Like you, I've gotten all sorts of kind of well, not threats, but you know, various threatening messages. At one point in time, my department secretary contacted the police because of the sort of messages that people are leaving on the phone for me.
Oh boy.
And
yeah, I bet.
Yeah, I mean, there's just no interest in discussing this and pursuing this whatsoever. And I think it's exactly what you're saying, that the background idea is, look, anyone doing this is a scumbag, and so who cares whether it's just or unjust?
Right.
And I think this is atrocious. I mean, you're just throwing away people's lives, like you said, doing enormous damage to people.
Yes.
Without an adequate case for doing so.
Yeah, and I think it's a very important issue. This is not just a couple of academic provocateurs, right, sitting on our ivory tower. I mean, we are that, but I think it's actually very important. I think it speaks to, for America, why we have such high age of consent laws relative to other countries. It speaks to our Puritanism. It speaks to the Puritanism of our culture. It's foundational, right? Number one. And number two, it speaks to, I mean, Sigmund Freud had the big explanation for this, which I find quite persuasive, which is that civilization requires the taboo on incest because civilization requires a hierarchy. And in the family, if everybody's having sex with everyone else, the hierarchy breaks down, and therefore there's no more model for a civilization within the family. And therefore you then have wild savages being produced out of those kinds of families, which, you know, I mean, if you look at the Middle Ages, when, as I said, incest was normal, you know, you can make a case for that. There was a lot of wild savage activity, uncontrolled. So civilization in the modern era, Freud says, and Foucault says this to some extent as well, civilization cracked down on that hard and first. That's the first taboo, Freud said, the first thing that they had to crack down on. Because again, you know, the father needs to be the head of the family. And if he's having sex with his daughter, then who's who and where's where and what's what, right? Yeah. And, you know, it's a speculative theory, but I think it's pretty, I'm persuaded by it.
In support of the Puritanism, I mean, we do criminalize plural marriage, for example.
Yeah, right.
Recently, we didn't allow for gay marriage. So, I mean, there's a number of policies. It's a little hard to see how they fit easily with a society that places primary emphasis on liberty.
Yeah, right.
And also places some sort of emphasis on evidence. I mean, what would be the evidence that, you know, plural marriage or gay marriage in some ways makes us worse off?
It's
a little hard to see what the evidence is for it.
Right. And and it would punish just countless, well, it has already punished countless people who did things that by anybody's lights were completely consensual, even if they were 16 or 17, because when that woman, usually it's a woman, turns 18, 19, 20, becomes a full-fledged adult, she still says, oh, there was nothing non-consensual about that.
Right. That's right. So one of the things, when you see that you have what would, if this were to exist, you'd have retrospective consent.
Yeah.
In addition, for a long time, they didn't prosecute it. So even if it was in the books, I think through the 70s, it was rare that this was the statutory rape, for example, was prosecuted, which tells you that people might have wanted some symbolic statement against it, but they really didn't think that it was worth pursuing, which suggests that they don't think it's a wrong-making feature. Maybe it's one of the cases where you want to get in the books that you're expressing disapproval and then just not act on it whatsoever.
Yeah, I know you've written about pornography. Have you written about sex work? Because this is relevant, right? Because
I've not written about sex work. I've written about pornography.
Right.
That was another area which I thought was fascinating. And I don't know, do you want me to talk about that?
Let me just say, I do. But my point there was that in sex work, this is really relevant because, of course, anybody under the age of 18 who sells sex, it is considered not just prostitution, it's considered sex slavery and trafficking. That's just by definition. You are going to prison for a long time if you ever are a pimp for a 17-year-old.
Sure.
And the thing is, of course, that many, if not most, 16 and 17 year old sex workers say that they're doing this because they want to do it, or it's preferable to their other options. And so right. they don't want to be punished, and they shouldn't be punished. So